Last time she spoke about stuff that led into a discussion about process, and I said, you know, we need to have a whole episode or a series of episodes on process. Before we get there, I want to ask a question that's kind of flipped on his head. And instead of saying, should designers code, I want to ask, should coders design? This has been on our list of potential topics since the beginning. And it interests me because, you know, there is a gap between what designers hand off and what coders implement. And obviously the solution is for someone in the middle to just do a brilliant job at both. But until that time, we need to somehow communicate and bridge that gap. And I personally, I know I would love coders that were, you know, front-end fanatics and that would just fix my design and make it better for the web rather than copying my mistakes from the Figma files.
Agreed there, yeah. I think you do design anyway, right? If you make something that people have to work with, it is design. And yeah, I think you have to be able, even as a developer, to understand that it has to look good and it has to work well and it has to feel right. Right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And also I think, of course you can make a sort of design system-y files where you go in as a designer and you fill in, you know, here's the 10 button styles and all the topography and all the elements, here's all the hover states, here's everything you need to make this into a website. Part of me feels like that only gets you so far, because once you're in the browser, stuff happens and, you know, it's responsive and it's, you know, the interaction didn't work as maybe you thought it might in Figma. There's always tweaks to be made. But also it's the short of having this master document, which is exhaustive. I feel like a lot of these decisions should be made when you're sketching in code rather than in Figma, because Figma isn't, you know, based on the same technology. So there's limits to what you can actually do there. But at the same time, the processes that I encounter, this is completely void. In fact, in most cases, the Figma file or Illustrator, whatever it might be, is treated as a specification. And if it's not there, well, we don't even think about it.
Yeah. So I usually tell my students the visual design students, I tell them what they should think about. And these are things that are not in Figma or not in Photoshop, not in Illustrator. So think about transitions. Think about interaction. Think about what happens between the responsive designs that you've made. So, right, if you made a small screen and a large screen, what happens in between there? These are important design decisions. And if you don't make them, a developer will make them. Yeah. And you cannot count on this developer to be a good designer, right? And if you let it up to the design, to the developer, it will probably break or be very ugly or not work at all. And then I tell developer students, well, you have to design these things because designers don't think about everything. Mm-hmm. So you have to think about everything. You make the final product. So make the final product. Don't come up with a sketch. Right? If something's missing, either come up with the excellent solution or go back to the designer and ask them how to do it.
Yeah, and I think you're onto something there. If something is missing or incomplete and you make a decision on how to solve that particular thing, you are designing whether you think you're a designer or not. If you choose to not do anything with it and the links don't have a hover state, well, you made a design decision right there. Yeah. What was it like when you, because you worked on the sort of development side of these big products back in the day, what was the process like for you guys, and to what extent were you involved with design? Because you strike me as a fairly opinionated developer.
Oh, really? So the process was somebody would make wireframes. Mm-hmm. Then the wireframes would get sent to a visual designer. And they would do some sort of a coloring by numbers exercise, just filling mm-hmm. in the layouts that the we used to call them interaction designers had made, but it wasn't really interaction design. It was more of a layout design, putting stuff yeah. on places.
Yeah.
And then in Photoshop, they would just make it pretty. And then they would send it over to me and I would have to make it work. And it was really a separated process. So the visual designer was not involved in the making of the wireframes, and I was not involved in both the wireframes and the yeah. Photoshop. So what happened a lot was that they came up with ideas that were not possible to make. We discussed that. In the end, that was good. I mean, if they only make things that were possible to make, we would still have a web that looked like IE6. Right, yeah. Things that were possible with IE6. And thanks to the fact that the designers came up with stuff that we were not able to make, we nowadays have border radius and we have gradients and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So in a way, I was wrong back then. but they did forget a lot of things. So there were never any hover states or focus states or other states. There was always, but that was the trend back then, a lack of contrast.
Yeah.
And there was never real content. So the headlines, for instance, if there were more than one article, the headlines would always fit. Right? Yeah,
perfectly.
Yeah, perfect content. Uh-huh. So, and these were, I think, these are things that are still not solved. I mean, these and so the designers I worked with, they would spend lots and lots of time on, I would call that, polishing a button. So they would have a button and they would just keep on polishing it until it really, really shines, right? Beautiful button, but it's only the default state. So they would forget that a button is an interactive thing. So there's no hover state. There's no idea of how should it work when you hover over it. Should there be a transition or shouldn't there be a transition, which is possible as well. And if there's a transition, what are the details of the transition? So there's lots of detail in what it looks like. So basically, these designers were making images and they were not making interactive stuff. And I think this is a problem because we leave that over to developers. So right yeah. now, right? And it's yeah. still the same thing. So back then it was my job as a front-end developer to fix this.
And how did you?
Well, that depended if there was time left, but there was never really much time left because the designers had spent so much time polishing their buttons that there was not much time anymore to make them work.
No time for hover states.
Nope. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I feel like nowadays, if I work with developers and, you know, I often forget about hover states or I think, oh yeah, we'll sort it out later. You know, there's certainly, if I look at my own process, there's room for improvement. But also don't mind, you know, a conversation about, oh, hey, you made this news article block thing. What should be hoverable here? What should happen? Okay, well, we'll just change the opacity and we'll make the thing underlined. You know, these are decisions that are easy to make quickly on the fly and can be solved in a conversation. With responsive design,
you need a short communication line between the designer and the developer then. So it should yes, be easy right. for them to yeah, reach yeah, you. Yeah, yeah.
This episode should be sponsored by Slack, which is I really like Slack for this sort of stuff, way more than email. You know, it's just and also way more than text messages or Signal or something. Slack is for me, perfect for this sort of stuff. But there's stuff that you can't just solve with three comments in Slack, which is what happens to this layout between those two breakpoints, like you mentioned earlier on as well, which then begs the question, how do we, as a designer, how do you even begin to design a complete scale from mobile 320 pixels to desktop 1600 pixels? You know, there's no, you don't have the budget for the whole thing, right? So maybe you decide just the smallest and the biggest, and then you have this massive gap in the middle. Maybe you decide, you know, you do the small, a medium, and a large, and then you're left with two smaller gaps. But ultimately, there has to be design inputs in the implementation process.
Yeah, so that's, I've been thinking about this a lot, because the first time I created a responsive website, the very, very, very first responsive website that I created that for the sales team of the design agency that I was working for back then. And so I went to the sales team and I showed them, look at what we can do. This is, we can do this now. And then they were amazed. They said, whoa, is that possible? Oh, that's incredible. And then the next day they came back to me and they said, we cannot sell this because we will have to make a desktop design, a mobile design, and something in between of every page, because that was what we used to do back then. We used to make very highly detailed Photoshop designs of every single page out there. And yeah, of course, you cannot sell that because it's ridiculous. These are, they're even leftover designs. I mean, you throw them away. It's not something that you can use later on. It's just something, right? So, and so I've thought about that a lot. And so what I teach my students right now is you don't have to make highly detailed designs of everything. But for instance, you make a desktop design, which is three columns. Well, I immediately see that there will be a problem between the one column and the three columns, right? So what's, or not really a problem, but somebody has to think about, so what's, happens there. So you can say, okay, we make a new design at 700 pixels or whatever, whatever you want. But you can also say, let's look at the content. So, and then you come back to what we discussed in a very early episode about the measure. So if you say the measure shouldn't be wider than 30 em or something, right? Just come up with a number, then you don't have to design all the stuff. You can simply say the measure shouldn't be wider than 30 em and it shouldn't be smaller than 15 or something. So once you have this, a good design, a good developer has everything they need to solve the problem.
Yep, on paper.
So it's just, but this is also something that works on paper, literally. So you can, you can sketch this.
Yeah. And there's the issue that, of course, designers are, we're notoriously bad for sort of understanding the concepts of CSS layouts in our design thinking. But also developers have, you know, you can, you, if you line up 10 front-end developers, you get 10 different approaches to front-end implementation. So, for example, an issue that I see time and time again, which is not so big that I care to spend lots of time fixing it, is exactly this. You jump from three columns to one column. And quite often, two columns doesn't work because, I don't know, maybe you have three items that need to be side by side, or maybe for whatever reason, the measure doesn't work when you, if you jump to two columns anyway, so you might as well just jump straight down to one column. Now, I was trying to explain this, a particular issue that often occurs. When you jump from a wide layout to a narrow layout, or to from a multi-column layout to a single column layout, what most developers in my experience do is they jump immediately to whatever the margins and paddings and typography of the mobile viewport is. The problem is this happens maybe at, I don't know, 800 pixels or something like that. So suddenly the measure becomes extremely long. The font sizes are way too small for the size that you're looking things at. And this could so easily be solved if there was just way more padding either side. So when you jump from something that completely fills the screen because you have three columns, you jump down to, oh, now it's just one column. That should no longer fill the entire screen. It needs to be, you know, padded to be at the sort of legible size in the middle or whatever.
Now, this is exactly what I teach my students. Yes. Exactly this.
And it's such a simple trick.
As a designer, you have to understand this problem.
Yeah.
And I think the paper designers actually, so when you designed for paper, you knew this stuff, right? You wouldn't make a column too small because it would be hard to read, and you wouldn't make it too wide because it would be hard to read. So you'd come up with just clever measures, right?
Yep, absolutely.
And the weird thing is that we somehow don't do that when designing for the web, or forget about it.
Yeah, I think the issue is that designers don't do it because they've already done the mobile view and they've done the whatever tablet view. And at some point, there's a transition. Yeah. Oh, but if you don't do the mobile view, I'm sure there'll be issues at the other end.
When I start, I don't start with a mobile view. I start somewhere in between, but a single column view.
Yeah.
The widest possible single column view.
That's smart.
But then the widest possible, so even with the white space. So I start with design right before it breaks to two columns.
Yeah.
So let's say if it breaks at 800 pixels, I never know where it breaks. It just breaks.
Yeah.
But then I would design it at 799.
Yeah.
For instance.
Yeah.
So this gives you what happens with the white space. What happens if a column reaches maximum width? What happens then? You don't have a perfect mobile design then. For instance, you might have a menu that's you can show the whole menu. You don't need a hamburger menu. Maybe that's the case. So then you will probably need to redesign a few components just to make sure that they look good on a really small screen. And then you need to make a new layout from when the two columns right before they break, right before they turn into three columns, right? So if you design at these points, then you need fewer designs. You need one design where you design all the components and what they look like and what they feel like. And then you can make a few designs for the exceptions that need detailed attention, and then you're done.
Yes, except just as you have this problem where if you design for the smallest viewport, the padding or the margin and padding for the smallest are kept throughout all the way up to the breakpoint. And I think, you know, if you have, okay, my paddings are very generous because I need a lot of white space around this text at whatever, 800-900 pixels. Then again, the developer will have to make a decision what happens to this padding as the screen shrinks. And you rely on having some sort of shared understanding that these paddings are flexible, you know, whether they're viewport based or percentage based or something, they have to flex. But again, maybe many developers work still in pixels, and maybe they use some sort of framework that is based on, this doesn't fit with whatever Bootstrap, because we use a four column grid here, and what you've placed it off the grid. You know, there's 100,000 million micro decisions that are difficult to cover.
That's why designers should be able to code.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Because it's really a pity, because I think there's a real big problem, because the problem is, designers are not interested in CSS, but developers are not interested in CSS as well.
Yep.
And this means we have websites that it's so underwhelming.
Yep.
We know that there's so much possible. I just gave a talk in Zurich but what my students make in 5 days, right? So this is a course that we give. It's just a fun course. It's playing with CSS. That's literally the title of the course.
Yeah.
So you can choose to do this course. It's not mandatory. So some students choose it because they want to learn a little bit about CSS. And they bring a poster that they like, and then they recreate the poster with CSS. And these are students that they don't know CSS.
Mm-hmm.
So they've written a few lines of CSS maybe, but they know nothing about it. And after 5 days, they create these incredible, incredible works of art that are interactive, that are beautiful, and that are something that we never see. That's the most thing that strikes me most, is that these are designs that are possible to make, but these are designs that we never see. And I think the reason why is because nobody's interested in CSS.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think those kind of designs, not that I've seen these particular examples, but they require design decisions to be made with mm-hmm. the tool. Not before the tool, and not following a sketch in some different medium. No, you have to try different variables, different units, different stuff to see what sticks, right?
Yeah.
Before this episode, I mentioned to you really briefly that I'm dabbling in some game design, and I'm just using Game Maker, and it's, you know, I'm a complete novice when it comes to code. But what I find is, maybe I have an idea what's going to happen in my head, and when I try and write this stuff, I change it 10 times over because, oh, actually, you know, the speed needs to be this, and it looks way cooler when it's that, and or if this happens, and actually this other thing needs to change as well, and the whole thing, it's like a living sketch. Just like when I work in Figma, I change things all the time, but I think unless you do that with code, you're always going to just get 90% representation of the latest thing that you thought was going to work. Getting all worked up now. You know.
I think it's frustrating as well. So I thought. So we have a new school here in Amsterdam. Mm. It's an associate degree in front-end development and front-end design. So it's only that. So it's a 2-year program, full-time school at the University of Applied Sciences here in Amsterdam. For front-end developers and front-end designers. That just started out a few weeks ago.
Amazing.
And I was invited to give a guest lecture last Friday, and I went there and I showed them the same similar presentation that I did in Zurich. And these students, they just were so eager. They was, oh, yes, can we do that? Let us try it.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful for the future.
Well, that's really, really good.
There's a new generation coming up that does care about CSS, I hope. And
is this happening outside of Amsterdam as well?
As far as I know, this is the only front end school.
Jesus,
especially if you look at it. Yeah. So there's lots of, let's say, commercial courses, 3-month courses, very intensive. But there you learn to become a React developer.
Yeah.
So, and in 3 months, you're a React developer and you have a job.
Yeah. And there's loads of courses that are, this is introduction to web design. You know, these are the basic technologies. Yeah. This is how you use them. But it's not.
And you're a pretty good React developer probably, but once people don't need React anymore, you're out of a job.
Yeah.
Because it's just React. Yeah. So the things that I teach here at this school is JavaScript, HTML, and CSS.
Yeah.
And they don't just teach you to develop with it, they teach you to design with it. It's really a design school, which I think is unique.
That's the real difference right there.
Yeah.
There was a...
So they don't care about frameworks. Well, they do care about frameworks, but they don't teach them.
Yeah.
So they teach the students to reach a level where they can choose a framework or they can adapt to a framework. But they always have a much more thorough knowledge of what's beyond or behind or underneath the framework.
It sounds a bit like in when I was in uni, we had almost no courses, maybe zero courses that taught us how to use Photoshop, Illustrator, InDesign. All the courses were about creating ideas and, you know, the stuff that you're trying to express, the rules of typography, history of design, whatever, not this is the menu in Photoshop. Do you know what I mean? You'll pick that stuff up. And I guess with HTML and CSS and JavaScript, you do need to learn the tool because the tool is complex, but you don't need thorough knowledge of all the frameworks out there.
No. And I think with Photoshop, there's some interesting stuff to learn, but these are not that much about Photoshop, but more about the principles that Photoshop is built upon. Mm. And this is light. How does light work?
Mm.
So lots of the channels and things like that, they're very interesting to understand, because once you understand them, you can actually stop upgrading Photoshop from Photoshop 3, because everything that was possible with Photoshop 3 is possible, or everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
I once saw a lecture by a guy who was an old-fashioned photo manipulator from before Photoshop. So he did it with I don't even know what these tools are, but these are scanning drums or something like that he used to talk about. I don't even know what they are. But he was able to all the effects that we can do nowadays with Photoshop, he could do them back then without Photoshop.
That's pretty amazing.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible.
The whole
Photoshop is based on these techniques.
Yeah.
So it's just a digitization of these things.
Yeah.
So it is interesting to learn these things.
Yes.
Because then you know what you're doing. You're not just making pretty stuff. You know what actually a blend mode is.
Yeah, to this day, I don't know what a blend mode is.
Yeah.
Just a generation too young.
it's different ways that things can be transparent, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's the layman's explanation, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a event thing that you invited me to, Vasilis, quite a long time ago now, where I was speaking to your students. Was it before the summer, I think? And I spoke to your students, and so did this other guy, Nils.
Nils, yeah.
And I had a super interesting conversation with him the day after, a couple of days later, on video chat somewhere. And we spoke about something. He mentioned something that I think really resonates in terms of this discussion of design and code and the sort of overlap between the two disciplines, and he called it design intention, which rather than your design file being what it used to be back in the day, like a very exhaustive, perfectly pixel rendered picture of the website, it is more of a visual guide to the intention behind the design. So, you know, maybe if we were able to speak in terms of I want this sort of behavior. I want the padding to be airy rather than tight. I want, you know, I'll give you this sketch and I'll explain to you how I feel this should work. But then you need to take that intention and I guess use it when you implement. And I think the way they work I can't recall his agency, it's a bit... You know, they can take some of that into the process. And I think if you have designers, developers working in the same room, this is something that might be possible as well.
Yeah. And it's actually something that it's how I think about. This is how I design, but I always design just with myself, right? Mm. I'm the designer and the developer.
Mm.
But exactly what Neil says, this is so. And this is also what I was trying to say about when you think about the, for instance, the measure, you think about, okay, how small can it be and how wide can it be? And you can think about the padding in a similar way, right? So there's a minimum and a maximum size there. So lots of this design can be just rules.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually at Primate, we were a bit... At least we were going in that direction when I was there, where we would have rules. We would even have rules for you know, vertical spacing, that we would define some unit. And it's almost arbitrary. But you have a unit, and then instead of saying, oh, this space should be 15 pixels, you say, no, that's one. And then you have a bigger space. Oh, that's a big, or that's five. You know, you have these like way wider terms, which means then when you're implementing something, you can see, oh, that looks like a double space rather than a single space. And then you make a decision and it's correct because it's not based on single pixels. It's based on an overarching framework of visual thinking. Yeah. And in that process is also, you know, then room to discuss the rules or to make decisions because you have these guiding principles or whatever. I quickly learned, of course, that stuff like that works when you've worked together as a team for a while. It does not work immediately when you start working with a new development team in a different country.
Yeah, and it works when you have developers that understand design.
Yeah.
Right, there's lots of developers, if you send them a file, they will just measure it with some sort of a measure tool and say, okay, here the side bar is 272 pixels.
Yeah.
The side bar should be 272 pixels.
Yeah.
Right, but it's also, if you say,
why isn't my design centered on the screen? Well, actually, if you look at your Figma sketch, it is 272 on with this side, but only 282 on this other side, so... You must have intended that, otherwise you wouldn't have made that mistake.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you need a team.
Yeah, you really need a team.
Yeah, and you need a good team to make good stuff. It's just, it's that simple. And it's pretty hard nowadays, I think, to find a good team because there are not many people like Niels. Niels is incredible, right? Niels is he's a real CSS designer.
Yeah,
he
absolutely.
He really understands CSS. He's even maybe a CSS artist. He understands CSS. He plays with CSS, and he knows how to develop. So,
he's the unicorn right there.
Yeah,
and it is hard to find people. All the time, I get asked, "Oh, do you know any designers or developers?" I'm even looking for developers, and it's where are they? Where are these people? I think once again, it's your students, Vasilis, that will change the industry.
It's not that many of them, though.
It's a slow start.
I mean, if I look at there's every year there's 50 students who do the minor web design and web development.
Yeah.
And out of these 50 students, maybe 20 are good.
Yeah.
And maybe 5 are really, really good.
Yeah.
And then of these 5, most of them will become developers who just do development stuff.
Yeah.
So lots of talent goes wasted because the industry doesn't know what to do with this talent.
No, it's
It's really sad. It's really, really sad. And I really think somehow, and this is also something that I'm trying from within the university, is we should somehow try to change the industry, that they understand that, well, this stuff can be and should be designed, and it shouldn't be good enough. It's not good enough. It's not at all.
Yeah. Good luck with that. maybe the university.
I'm not in a hurry anymore.
Maybe they need to set up a agency. I know I think a university in Edinburgh, they do like as a course for the students, they have to make their own design agency, you know, and they have to get real clients and solve real problems and stuff. Maybe you can start there, and then you have a new model of creating publications for the web instead of the old model. Because, you know, if you run into big shops and there's like 200 people involved, how are you even going to begin to change the process? Because this change that we're talking about, it's at some sort of basic radical level. It's not a small tweak to the final step of the process. You know, it's changing the whole thing.
Yeah. So I tell some of my students, you should start a company.
Yep.
Don't go work somewhere. Start your own.
Yep.
And we'll send you our talent.
Yeah.
Maybe that will work in the future. Yeah. Maybe this new school will somehow change stuff in the Netherlands. I don't know.
I guess it's a matter of quantity of this new thinking. The more people think this way, the sooner these agencies will start popping up, and undoubtedly they'll produce better work.
The thing is, will people recognize it as better work? What are people happy with?
Yeah,
I really don't know.
I mean,
so if you
maybe
look at
developers, not.
Developers nowadays, they really like their frameworks and they really like their development optimization tooling and they really like themselves. but they don't care about the people they work for. Well, it seems to me like this. The trend is very much into what makes me happy. So I want lots of money. I want a big computer, a good computer, and I want a nice workflow.
Yeah.
And I use frameworks that are so good, they think, that whatever I do with it, the UX is fine. But it's not.
No.
It's not good enough.
I think that this new wave of talent coming from Amsterdam, not only will the results or the websites be better from a design, accessibility, usability, even coding perspective, I think they'll be cheaper. I think a lot of the things that we butt our heads against now in the current process, in the old model, so to speak, it's there because it's saving us the agency's money or it's avoiding risk, right? You have this waterfall model because the designs are done here, they're signed off, then they get passed on, then it's signed off again, then it gets passed on to the developer. And it's not, even if you have someone super mega creative and talented with a great understanding of design, there's nothing they could do at that point, like you've experienced in your career, because all the decisions have been made, it's been signed off, implemented, this is your budget, that's the end of it.
Yeah.
And I think that saves us from risk and, you know, potential losses, but it also makes the whole process quite expensive to begin with.
Yeah. So maybe that's fine for 90% of the clients, 90% of the websites. I mean, if you want to be a boring developer, be a boring developer. If you want to be a boring designer, be a boring designer. Make standard stuff. Just make stuff that other people have made before. I mean, it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm missing on the web is this 10% that actually makes new stuff, that comes up with fantastic stuff, that plays with the stuff, right?
Mm.
And it seems like even the clients that want that stuff, they don't exist.
Yeah, I think you're right there. And I think that has always been the case. I think in every design course or every design student, they look up to these amazing designers and they're like, how the hell did you find a client that would let you do that on the cover of their magazine? You know, it's rare. But yeah. I feel like even humbler ambitions, I feel like I have even humbler ambitions in that. Even the basic stuff, the stuff that's been done forever and the stuff that lots of my clients want, I just want a better way of doing that. Do you know what I mean? I want to do that without all this faff, without the back and forth and the, oh, sorry, that's going to cost you now 30 hours of development time to fix this template. It's just, come on, there must be a better way of doing this, even the simple stuff.
Yeah. Agreed.
Whew. I think I'm going to go and take the rest of the day off, have a glass of wine.
Yeah. I'm just going back to teaching. So much easier, the design.
Yeah, oh my God. I like my new role now as more of a consultant, but it's this finding the talent, putting people to work together, creating even the most basic stuff of a acceptable quality. It's so painfully slow and hard sometimes.
Yeah.
So sure. Send me your students.
I'll send them all to you.
Great.
Hope you have a big shed.
Oh no, they can work remotely. That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, Espen, it was really nice talking to you again.
Yeah, likewise.
Even though we did get a little bit agitated.
Yeah, that's the only way you get somewhere, to have some emotion.
Yeah.
All right, I'll speak to you
a
next
Norwegian
time.
A Norwegian and a Dutch guy showing emotion. That's,
yeah, exactly.
That's rare.
Or just two cranky old men just screaming at the world.